shave and wear appropriate clothes. It is true I had gotten a little hairy in the woods. They had rules, these people. They had expectations, and if you did not comply, you were socially shunned. Well, not really shunned, just smiled at. Smiled at a great deal. Smiled at and watched and giggled over when passed in the hall. I confess I enjoyed being different. I got more attention by being the hippie guy than I had when I was normal. I felt better in a lot of ways, more superior, because I was no longer sheltered. I had been in the world, and the world had approved of me. They were cute, these little Christian people. I liked them. They reminded me of my roots, where I had come from all those days ago, before my month in the woods with the pot smokers and the hippies and the free love for everybody. When the director's assistant told me to shave, she told me sheepishly. She knew it was a silly request. "Hey, listen," I told her, "I will do exactly what the man tells me to do, you know, because I respect the man. I don't want to fight." She smiled back at me, seeing the genius of my emotional intelligence. "Do you need a razor or something?" She looked at me, sort of smirking. "You know," I replied, leaning against the wall in the hallway, "I think I have one somewhere. I have a backpack or something somewhere." "You don't know where your stuff is?" she asked, obviously coming from a primitive, materialistic, territorial paradigm. "Oh, you know, it's probably in my room, or maybe around, you know, who knows." "Well, maybe you should put it somewhere where you won't lose it." "Well, you know, if I lost it, what would I have lost, right?" I asked her. "You would have lost your backpack," she answered matter-of-factly. She had sort of a bothered, questioning look on her face. "Right. Right, but, you know, what would any of us lose by losing our possessions? Maybe we would gain something, like relationships, like the beauty of good friends, intimacy, you know what I mean, man? Like, we wouldn't be losing anything if we lost our stuff. We'd be gaining everything." "Yeah," she said. "That's fascinating. Well, just shave, okay? If you need a razor, I will get you one." She was getting very flustered or something, really wanting to pull out of the conversation. I figured she hadn't met anybody fascinating like me before. "Yeah," I told her. "Yeah, if I need anything, I will come looking for you." "That's sweet of you. Real sweet." "Honestly, it's my job," she told me. "Cool. That's chill," I said. "What?" "That's chill. You know, on ice." "Right." She said this very slowly. She stood there silently, just looking at me like I was a big, mysterious puzzle. "So tell me," I said, breaking the silence. "What do your people call you?"
"My people?"
"Yeah, like your friends, your close ones."
"Are you asking my name?"
"Right on, your name. What's your name?"
"Janet."
"Janet, right. Janet. Planet Janet from the Jupiter scene." Long pause.
"Right," she said slowly.
"So are you in school, Janet? Like, are you in college or just the school of life?"
"I was homeschooled.
I'm going to Bob Jones next year."
"Bob who?"
"Jones. It's a college." "Cool. That's chill."
"Listen, Dan," she started.
"Don," I corrected her. "My name is Don, actually."
"Right," she said slowly. "Is that what your people call you?"
"Yeah." I think she might have been making fun of me or flirting or something.
"You should probably shave," she continued. "And I wasn't going to tell you, but maybe you should take a shower." She was definitely flirting. No prob, Janet, you know. Thanks for mentioning it. I've been living in the woods, you know, out in the open and all. Don't need a shower out there, right? Not out there, no. But since you will be with us now, you know, maybe you should try it out. Right on. Cool to know the rules, you know. Well, Don, it was certainly interesting meeting you. I'm sure I will see you again. Maybe won't recognize you, though. She motioned toward my beard and smiled. I didn't know what she meant at first, but then I got it. She meant she wouldn't recognize me after I shaved. Oh, yeah, cool, I told her. Maybe not, huh? But don't worry, I'll remind you who I am. Right, she said slowly, and then walked away, shaking her head. While at camp, we were encouraged to attend church. Buses went on Sundays to a couple of different churches. Both of them were a little stiff. I felt like both churches came to the table with a them and us mentality, them being the liberal non-Christians in the world, and us being Christians. I felt, once again, that there was this underlying hostility for homosexuals and Democrats and, well, hippie types. I cannot tell you how much I did not want liberal or gay people to be my enemies. I liked them. I cared about them, and they cared about me. I learned that in the woods. I had never felt so alive as I did in the company of my liberal friends. It isn't that the Christians I had been with had bad community. They didn't. I just liked the community of the hippies because it was more forgiving, more, I don't know, healthy. The real issue in the Christian community was that it was conditional. You were loved, but if you had questions, questions about whether the Bible was true, or whether America was a good country, or whether last week's sermon was good, you were not so loved. You were loved in word, but there was, without question, a social commodity that was being withheld from you until you shaped up. By towing the party line, you earned social dollars. By being yourself, you did not. If you wanted to be valued, you became a clone. These are broad generalizations, and they are unfair, but this is what I was thinking at the time. Bear with me, and I will tell you what I learned. I began to attend a Unitarian church. All Souls Unitarian Church in Colorado Springs was wonderful. The people were wonderful. Like my friends in the woods, they freely and openly accepted everybody the church didn't seem to accept. I don't suppose they accepted fundamentalists, but neither did I at the time. I was comfortable there. Everybody was comfortable there. I did not like their flaky theology, though. I did not like the way they changed words in the hymns, and I did not like the fact they ignored the Bible, but I loved them, and they really liked me. I loved the smiley faces, the hugs, the vulnerable feel to the place, the wonderful old gray-haired professors, former alcoholics and drug addicts, the intellectual feminists who greeted me with the kindest, most authentic faces that I understood as invitations to tell my story. I began to understand that my pastors and leaders were wrong, that the liberals were not evil. They were liberal for the same reason Christians were Christians, because they believed their philosophies were right, good, and beneficial for the world. I had been raised to believe there were monsters under the bed, but I had peaked in a moment of bravery and found a wonderful world, a good world, better, in fact, than the one I had known. The problem with Christian community was that we had ethics. We had rules and laws and principles to judge each other against. There was love in Christian community, but it was conditional love. Sure, we called it unconditional, but it wasn't. There were bad people in the world and good people in the world. We were raised to believe this. If people were bad, we treated them as though they were either evil or charity. If they were bad and rich, they were evil. If they were bad and poor, they were charity. Christianity was always right. We were always looking down on everybody else. And I hated this. I hated it with a passion. Everything in my soul told me it was wrong. It felt to me as wrong as sin. I wanted to love everybody. I wanted everything to be cool. I realize this sounds like tolerance, and to many in the church, the word tolerance is profanity, but that is precisely what I wanted. I wanted tolerance. I wanted everybody to leave everybody else alone, regardless of their religious beliefs, regardless of their political affiliation. I wanted people to like each other. Hatred seemed, to me, the product of ignorance. I was tired of biblical ethic being used as a tool with which to judge people rather than heal them. I was tired of Christian leaders using biblical principles to protect their power, to draw a line in the sand separating the good army from the bad one. The truth is, I had met the enemy in the woods and discovered they were not the enemy. I wondered whether any human being could be an enemy of God. On the other hand, however, I felt by loving liberal people, I mean by really endorsing their existence, I was betraying the truth of God because I was encouraging them in their lives apart from God. I felt like there was this war going on between us, the Christians, and them, the homosexuals and environmentalists and feminists. By going to a Unitarian church and truly loving those people, I was helping them. I was giving joy to their life, and that didn't feel right. It was a terrible place to be. This was, at the time, my primary problem with Christian faith. With all its talk about pure love, in the end it shook down to conditional love. Again, this is a provocative statement, but I want to walk you through the emotional process I went through. How could I merge the culture of the woods and the Unitarian Church with Christian culture and yet not abandon the truth of Scripture? How could I love my neighbor without endorsing what I truly believed was unhealthy spirituality? My answer did not come for many years, and as for that summer, I became very confused. I gave in to keep the peace. I stopped going to the Unitarian Church. I shaved. I cut the hippie act and made friends, good friends, friends whom I loved and who loved me. From time to time, I would overhear comments by my friends, destructive comments about the political left or about homosexuals or Democrats, and I never knew what to do with those comments. They felt right in my head, but not in my heart. I went along, and looking back, I think we all went along. Even the people who were making the comments were going along. What else was there to do? Truth is truth. It is always the simple things that change our lives. And these things never happen when you're looking for them to happen. Life will reveal answers at the pace life wishes to do so. You feel like running, but life is on a stroll. This is how God does things. My realization came while attending an alumni social for Westmont College. I had never attended Westmont, but my friend Michelle did, and she invited me. Greg Spencer, a communications professor, was to speak, and Michelle thought I might enjoy the lecture. I did. More than I can say. The lecture was about the power of metaphor. Spencer opened by asking us what metaphors we think of when we consider the topic of cancer. We gave him our answers, all pretty much the same. We battle cancer. We fight cancer. We are rebuilding our white blood cells, things like that. Spencer pointed out that the overwhelming majority of metaphors we listed were war metaphors. They dealt with battle. He then proceeded to talk about cancer patients and how, because of war metaphor, many people who suffer with cancer feel more burdened than in fact they should. Most of them are frightened beyond their need to be frightened, and this affects their health. Some, feeling that they have been thrust into a deadly war, simply give up. If there were another metaphor, a metaphor more accurate, perhaps cancer would not prove so deadly. Science has shown that the way people think about cancer affects their ability to deal with the disease, thus affecting their overall health. Professor Spencer said that if he were to sit down with his family and tell them he had cancer, they would be shocked, concerned, perhaps even in tears, and yet cancer is nothing near the most deadly of diseases. Because of war metaphor, the professor said, we are more likely to fear cancer when actually, most people survive the disease. Mr. Spencer then asked us about another area in which he felt metaphors cause trouble. He asked us to consider relationships. What metaphors do we use when we think of relationships? We value people, I shouted out. Yes, he said, and wrote it on his little whiteboard. We invest in people, another person added. And soon enough, we had listed an entire whiteboard of economic metaphor. Relationships could be bankrupt, we said. People are priceless, we said. All economic metaphor. I was taken aback. And that's when it hit me like so much epiphany getting dislodged from my arteries. The problem with Christian culture is we think of love as a commodity. We use it like money. Professor Spencer was right, and not only was he right, I felt as though he had cured me, as though he had let me out of my cage. I could see it very clearly. If somebody is doing something for us, offering us something, be it gifts, time, popularity, or what have you, we feel they have value. We feel they are worth something to us, and perhaps we feel they are priceless. I could see it so clearly, and I could feel it in the pages of my life. This was the thing that had smelled so rotten all these years. I used love like money. The church used love like money. With love, we withheld affirmation from the people who did not agree with us, but we lavishly financed the ones who did. The next few days unfolded in a thick line of melancholy thought and introspection. I used love like money, but love doesn't work like money. It is not a commodity. When we barter with it, we all lose. When the church does not love its enemies, it fuels their rage. It makes them hate us more. Here's how it worked out on a personal level. There was this guy in my life at the time, a guy I went to church with whom I honestly didn't like. I thought he was sarcastic and lazy and manipulative, and he ate with his mouth open so that food almost fell from his chin when he talked. He began and ended every sentence with the word dude. Dude, did you see Springer yesterday? He would say. They had this fat lady on there who was doing it with a midget. It was crazy, dude. I want to get me a midget, dude. That's the sort of thing he would talk about. It was very interesting to him. I don't enjoy not liking people, but sometimes these things feel as though you are not in control of them. I never chose not to like the guy. It felt more like the dislike of him chose me. Regardless, I had to spend a good amount of time with him as we were working on a temporary project together. He began to get under my skin. I wanted him to change. I wanted him to read a book, memorize a poem, or explore morality, at least as an intellectual concept. I didn't know how to communicate to him that he needed to change, so I displayed it on my face. I rolled my eyes. I gave him dirty looks. I would mouth the word loser when he wasn't looking. I thought somehow he would sense my disapproval and change his life in order to gain my favor. In short, I withheld love. After Greg Spencer's lecture, I knew what I was doing was wrong. It was selfish, and what's more, it would never work. By withholding love from my friend, he became defensive. He didn't like me. He thought I was judgmental, snobbish, proud, and mean. Rather than being drawn to me, wanting to change,
he was repulsed. I was guilty of using love like money, withholding it to get somebody to be who I wanted them to be. I was making a mess of everything, and I was disobeying God. I became convicted about these things, so much so that I had some trouble getting sleep. It was clear that I was to love everybody, be delighted at everybody's existence, and I had fallen miles short of God's aim. The power of Christian spirituality has always rested in repentance, so that's what I did. I repented. I told God I was sorry. I replaced economic metaphor in my mind with something different, a free gift metaphor or a magnet metaphor. That is, instead of withholding love to change somebody, I poured it on lavishly. I hoped that love would work like a magnet, pulling people from the mire and toward healing. I knew this was the way God loved me. God had never withheld love to teach me a lesson. Here is something very simple about relationships that Spencer helped me discover. Nobody will listen to you unless they sense that you like them. If a person senses that you do not like them, that you do not approve of their existence, then your religion and your political ideas will all seem wrong to them. If they sense that you like them, then they are open to what you have to say. After I repented, things were different. But the difference wasn't with my friend. The difference was with me. I was happy. Before, I had all this negative tension flipping around in my gut, all this judgmentalism and pride and loathing of other people. I hated it, and now I was set free. I was free to love. I didn't have to discipline anybody. I didn't have to judge anybody. I could treat everybody as though they were my best friend, as though they were rock stars or famous poets, as though they were amazing, and to me, they became amazing. Especially my new friend. I loved him. After I decided to let go of judging him, I discovered he was very funny. I mean, really hilarious. I kept telling him how funny he was. And he was smart. Quite brilliant, really. I couldn't believe that I had never seen it before. I felt as though I had lost an enemy and gained a brother. And then he began to change. It didn't matter to me whether he did or not, but he did. He began to get a little more serious about God. He gave up television for a period of time as a sort of fast. He started praying and got regular about going to church. He was a great human being, getting even better. I could feel God's love for him. I loved the fact that it wasn't my responsibility to change somebody, that it was God's, that my part was just to communicate love and approval. When I am talking to somebody, there are always two conversations going on. The first is on the surface. It is about politics or music or whatever it is our mouths are saying. The other is beneath the surface, on the level of the heart. And my heart is either communicating that I like the person I am talking to, or I don't. God wants both conversations to be true. That is, we are supposed to speak truth in love. If both conversations are not true, God is not involved in the exchange. We are on our own, and on our own, we will lead people astray. The Bible says that if you talk to somebody with your mouth and your heart does not love them, that you were like a person standing there smashing two cymbals together. You were only annoying everybody around you. I think that is very beautiful and true. Now, since Greg Spencer told me about truth, when I go to meet somebody, I pray that God will help me feel his love for them. I ask God to make it so both conversations, the one from the mouth and the one from the heart, are true. Chapter 19. Love. How to really love yourself. I wish Annie DeFranco wasn't a lesbian. I'm listening to her right now, and I think I would marry her if she would have me.
I would hang out in the front row at all her concerts and sing along and pump my fist and get angry at all the right times. Then later, on the bus, she would lay her head on a pillow in my lap, and I would get my fingers tangled in her dreadlocks while we watched Charlie Rose on the television. Some friends and I were walking to our cars one night outside the Roseland after an Emmylou Harris concert, and I could see into her bus, and Charlie Rose was on the television. I thought to myself, I like that show. And part of me wanted to knock on the window and ask if I could come in. I would not have bothered her or even asked for an autograph. I would have just watched television. He was interviewing Bishop Tutu, I think. By the time I got home, the interview was over. If Annie DeFranco and I got married, I would write books on the bus rides between cities, and in the evening, after the concerts, we would watch Charlie Rose, and three or four times each night we would whisper, "Good question, Charlie, good question." But none of this will happen because Annie DeFranco is not attracted to men, I don't think. Otherwise, we would be on. The thing about Reed College you may not know is that it is a beautiful place. I mean, the people are beautiful, and I love them. My housemate Grant and I were on campus the other day helping kids move into their dorms, and we met this kid, Nathan, who needed us to move a couch up to his room. Grant and I were sort of surprised when Nathan started talking to us because, no kidding, he sounded just like Elmer Fudd. He was short and stocky, and nobody but Elmer Fudd himself sounds more like Elmer Fudd than Nathan. Grant almost started laughing, but we tried very hard to listen to the person inside the voice. And so on the way to the storage shed, Nathan opened up and told us that as a summer job, he worked at Los Alamos, researching nuclear weapons. Nathan does not know his left from his right, which I thought was a peculiar characteristic, given he is one of the smartest people in the world or something. We would come to an intersection and he would point and say, in a perfect Elmer Fudd dialect, I can't do accents at all, "Go that way, Don. That is the way to the storage shed." I was speaking at a pastor's conference in San Francisco, and I was telling them about my friends from Reed and what it looks like to talk about Jesus in that place. Somebody asked me what it was like to deal with all the immorality at Reed, and that question really struck me because I have never thought of Reed as an immoral place. And I suppose I never thought of it as an immoral place because somebody like Nathan can go there and talk like Elmer Fudd, and nobody will ever make fun of him. And if Nathan were to go to my church, which I love and would give my life for, he would unfortunately be made fun of by somebody somewhere, behind his back and all, but it would happen. And that is such a tragic crime. Nobody would bother to find out that he is a genius. Nobody would know that he is completely comfortable talking the way he talks and not knowing his left from his right, because he has spent 4 years in a place where what you are on the surface does not define you. It does not label you. And that is what I love about Reed College, because even though there are so many students having sex and tripping on drugs and whatever, there is also this foundational understanding that other people exist and they are important. And to me, Reed is like heaven in that sense. I wish everybody could spend 4 years in a place like that, being taught the truth, that they matter regardless of their faults, regardless of their insecurities. Television drives me crazy sometimes because everybody is so good-looking, and yet you walk through the aisles of the grocery stores and nobody looks like that. Somebody told me that in London, people don't judge you as much by the way you look, and I think it is true because late night on PBS, they play shows out of England and the actors aren't good-looking. And I sit there wondering if anybody else is watching and asking the same question. Why aren't the actors in London good-looking? And I already know the answer to that question. It is that America is one of the most immoral countries in the world and that our media has reduced humans to slabs of meat. And there will always be this tension while I live in this country, because none of this will ever change. Annie DeFranco, in her song 32 Flavors, says that she is a poster girl with no poster. She is 32 flavors and then some, and she is beyond our peripheral vision, so we might want to turn our heads because someday we're going to get hungry and eat all of the words we just said. And just about everybody I know loves those lines because they speak of heaven and of hope and the idea that someday a king will come and dictate through some mystical act of love an existence in which everybody has to eat their own words because we won't be allowed to judge each other on the surface of things anymore. And this fills me with hope. Jean-Paul Sartre said, "Hell is other people." But that Indian speaker I really like named Ravi Zacharias says that heaven can be other people too, and that we have the power to bring a little of heaven into the lives of others every day. I know this is true, because I have felt it when Penny or Tony tells me I mean something to them and they love me. I pray often that God would give me the strength and dignity to receive their love. My friend Julie from Seattle says the key to everything rests in the ability to receive love. And what she says is right because my personal experience tells me so. I used to not be able to receive love at all, and to this day I have some problems. But it isn't like it used to be. My eye would find things on television and in the media, and somehow I would compare myself to them without really knowing I was doing it. And this really screwed me up because I never for a second felt I was worthy of anybody's compliments. I was dating this girl for a while, this cute writer from the South, and she was great, really the perfect girl. And we shared tastes on everything from music to movies, all the important stuff, and yet I could not really thrive in the relationship because I could never believe her deeply when she expressed affection. Our love was never a two-way conversation. I didn't realize I was doing it, but I used to kick myself around quite a bit in my head, calling myself a loser and that sort of thing. There was nothing this girl could do to get through to me. She would explain her feelings, and I should have been happy with that, but I always needed more. And then I resented the fact that I needed more because, well, it is such a needy thing to need more, and so I lived inside this conflict. I would sit on the porch at Graceland and watch cars go around the circle while all this stuff went around in my heart. There was no peace at all. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. Andrew the protester, the one who looks like Fidel Castro, was living in the house back then, and he is such an amazing listener that I would talk to him, and he would nod his head and say, "Don, man, I didn't know you were feeling any of this." But I was. And it got worse. I would mope around the house all day, and I couldn't get any writing done. It had been the same in all my relationships. There was always within me this demand for affection, this needy, clingy monkey on my back. I wouldn't be satisfied unless the girl wanted to get married right away, unless she was panicky about it, and even then I would imagine a non-existent scenario in which she finds another man or breaks up with me because of the way I look. I would find myself getting depressed about conversations that never even took place. Finally, Andrew said I should meet with Diane, who is this beautiful married woman who goes to our church and mothers us and speaks love into our lives because most of us are basket cases. Diane was studying at a local seminary to be a counselor, and Andrew recommended that I ask her to take a shot at all my troubles. I didn't want to do it at first because Diane's husband is an elder, and I had spoken at church a few times, so everybody thought I was normal. Certainly, if I talked to Diane, she would go home and tell her husband I was nuts, and then it would get around the church. And when everybody thinks you were nuts, you finally just give in to their pressure and actually go nuts. But I was desperate. So I called Diane. She was beautiful and soft and kind, with a tender voice, and she showed up at the house, and I put some coffee on. We went into my office and I closed the door in case one of my roommates walked by and saw me talking to Diane and discovered I was nuts. I sat in a chair and Diane sat on the couch, and I wrung my hands a bit before starting in. "Well, you see, Diane, I'm in this relationship with this girl, and she is great, she really is. It's just that It is very hard for me, you know.
You mean it's hard for you to have feelings for her?
I'm not gay.
Diane laughed.
I didn't mean it that way, Don.
I do have feelings for her, I said with sincerity.
They're almost too strong, you know. I have trouble sleeping and eating and thinking about anything else. It's hard for me to be in a relationship. It always has been. And that makes me want to bail. I would just rather not be in the relationship at all than go through this torture. But I promised myself I wouldn't run from it this time. But I feel like the meaning of life is riding on whether or not she likes me, and I think she does. She says she does, but it still drives me crazy.
Whether or not she likes you, Don, or whether or not she loves you?
Yeah, that too. Whether or not she loves me. Diane sat there and made listening noises the whole time I was talking. And when I told her how I will go days without eating, she looked at me and sighed and oohed and was definitely letting me know that this behavior was neither normal nor healthy. I think I could have told her that Elvis Presley was alive and living in my closet, and she would have been less surprised. When you are a writer and a speaker, sometimes people think you have your crap together.
You seem so normal, Don. You have a company and are a writer and all.
Diane looked at me, bewildered.
Yeah.
But there is something wrong with me, isn't there? I was half hoping she would say no. I was hoping she would explain that everybody is nuts when they get into a relationship, but then it turns euphoric shortly after marriage and sex. But she didn't.
Well, Don, there is. There is something wrong with you.
Oh, man, I said. I just knew it. I just knew I was a wacko. I thought about that movie, A Beautiful Mind, and wondered whether any of my housemates existed or whether those guys who kept following me were in the FBI. Diane noted the concern on my face and responded, smiling and kind.
It's not that bad, Don.
Don't worry. It's just that for some reason you were letting this girl name you.
What do you mean, name me?
Well, you were letting her decide your value, you know? Your value has to come from God. And God wants you to receive his love and to love yourself too. And what she was saying was true. I knew it was true. I could feel that it was true. But it also felt wrong. I mean, it felt like it was an arrogant thing to do, to love myself, to receive love. I knew that all the kicking myself around, all the hating myself, was not coming from God, that those voices were not God whispering in my ear, but it felt like I had to listen to them. It felt like I had to believe the voices were telling the truth.
God loves you, Don.
Diane looked at me with a little moisture in her eyes. I felt like Matt Damon in that scene in Good Will Hunting where Robin Williams keeps saying, "It's not your fault, it's not your fault." And Matt Damon just freaks out and collapses into Robin Williams's arms and secures an Academy Award for both of them. I thought about acting out that scene with Diane, but it didn't feel right, so I let it go.
"Yeah, I know," I told her.
"I know God loves me." And I did know. I just didn't believe. It was such crap, such psychobabble. I had heard it before, but hearing that stuff didn't silence the voices. Still, there was something in Diane's motherly eyes that said it was true, and I needed that. I needed to believe it was true. I needed something to tell the voices when they started chanting at me. Diane and I talked for another half hour, and she oohed and sighed and made me feel listened to. She was wonderful, and I never once felt stupid or weak for talking to her. I just felt honest and real and relieved. She said she would get me some literature and that she wanted to get together again soon. She said she would pray for me. When she left, I decided to start praying about all of this too. I couldn't believe I hadn't prayed about it before. It's just that it never seemed like a spiritual problem. I prayed and asked God to help me figure out what was wrong with me. Things got worse with the girl. We would spend hours on the phone working through the math of our relationship, but nothing added up, which I received as only a sign of my incompetence, and this made me more sad than before. Then she did it. She decided we didn't need to be in touch anymore. She broke it off. She sent me a letter saying that I didn't love myself and could not receive love from her. There was nothing she could do about it, and it was killing her. I wandered around the house for an hour just looking at the blank walls, making coffee or cleaning the bathroom, not sure when my body was going to explode in sobs and tears. I was scrubbing the toilet when the voices began. I'd listened to them so often before, but on this day they were shouting. They were telling me that I was as disgusting as the urine on the wall around the toilet. And then the sentiment occurred. I am certain it was the voice of God because it was accompanied by such a strong epiphany, like a movement in a symphony or something. The sentiment was simple. Love your neighbor as yourself. And I thought about that for a second and wondered why God would put that phrase so strongly in my mind. I thought about our neighbor Mark, who was tall and skinny and gay, and I wondered whether God was telling me I was gay, which was odd because I had never felt gay, but then it hit me that God was not telling me I was gay. He was saying I would never talk to my neighbor the way I talked to myself, and that somehow I had come to believe it was wrong to kick other people around, but it was okay to do it to myself. It was as if God had put me in a plane and flown me over myself so I could see how I was connected. All the neighborhoods that were falling apart because I would not let myself receive love from myself, from others, or from God. And I wouldn't receive love because it felt so wrong. It didn't feel humble, and I knew I was supposed to be humble. But that was all crap, and it didn't make any sense. If it is wrong for me to receive love, then it is also wrong for me to give it, because by giving it, I am causing somebody else to receive it, which I had presupposed was the wrong thing to do. So I stopped. And I mean that. I stopped hating myself. It no longer felt right. It wasn't manly or healthy, and I cut it out. That was about a year ago, and since then I have been relatively happy. I'm not kidding. I don't sit around and talk bad about myself anymore. The girl and I got back together, and she could sense the difference in me, and she liked it, and I felt that I was operating a completely new machine. I couldn't believe how beautiful it was to receive love, to have the authority to love myself, to feel that it was right to love myself. When my girlfriend told me how she felt, I was able to receive it. And we had this normal relationship that in the end didn't work because we realized we weren't for each other. When we finally closed it out, it didn't hurt because I trusted that God had something else for me. And if he didn't, it didn't mean he didn't love me. From that point on, the point in the bathroom, I had confidence. Odd, but true. And so I have come to understand that strength, inner strength, comes from receiving love as much as it comes from giving it. I think apart from the idea that I am a sinner and God forgives me, this is the greatest lesson I have ever learned. When you get it, it changes you. My friend Julie from Seattle told me that the main prayer she prays for her husband is that he will be able to receive love. And this is the prayer I pray for all my friends because it is the key to happiness. God's love will never change us if we don't accept it. Chapter 20. Jesus. The lines on his face. A guy I know named Alan went around the country asking ministry leaders questions. He went to successful churches and asked the pastors what they were doing, why what they were doing was working. It sounded very boring, except for one visit he made to a man named Bill Bright, the president of a big ministry. Alan said he was a big man, full of life, who listened without shifting his eyes. Alan asked a few questions. I don't know what they were, but as a final question, he asked Dr. Bright what Jesus meant to him. Alan said Dr. Bright could not answer the question. He said Dr. Bright just started to cry. He sat there in his big chair behind his big desk and wept. When Alan told that story, I wondered what it was like to love Jesus that way. I wondered, quite honestly, if that Bill Bright guy was just nuts or if he really knew Jesus in a personal way, so well that he would cry at the very mention of his name. I knew then that I would like to know Jesus like that, with my heart, not just my head. I felt like that would be the key to something. I was watching one of those news shows on television several months ago about a woman whose son was on death row. He had killed a man and buried him in the woods. The television show followed the woman around during her son's last few days. The cameras were there for the last visit when the son, a young black man, sat across from his mother in the prison visiting room, and the mother had tears in her eyes and was trying so very hard to disguise the fear and regret and confusion and panic. I sat on the couch uncomfortably, and I wanted to jump through the screen and stop it all. I remembered saying to myself, "I hate this," but I kept watching. And there was a little girl there, the man's tiny sister, and she was sitting on his lap, and she didn't know he was going to die, but he was saying to be good and to do homework and don't tell any lies and obey her mama. Then the television showed the mother in her apartment a couple of days later, a sort of run-down hotel room in the ghetto, in the projects, and they didn't narrate anything. They just let the cameras roll as the woman paced up and down in front of the bed. The kids, the three beautiful children, ran in and out the open door, in and out of the heat where there was some sunset light happening. And the phone rang, and the woman went over and sat on the side of the bed and picked up the phone. She held it kind of shakily and listened without saying anything. She just said yes, in sort of a gut whisper, and then she put the phone back down, but it didn't hang up right. She fell to her knees and then got up and screamed and shook her fists at the ceiling. She turned and ran out the door into the courtyard of this run-down apartment complex, and as the camera pulled to look out the open door, they showed this large black woman collapse to the ground, screaming into the dirt and pounding her fist. I thought of that scene much later when my friend Julie and I were driving down from Yosemite, listening to Patty Griffin sing Mary on the CD player. In the song, Patty talks about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and what it must have been like the day her son was killed. She paints this painful picture of Mary inside her house, cleaning, and as the song played, I imagined Mary washing down the counters and sweeping the floors, frantically, trying not to think about what they had done to her son that morning. And I imagined Mary falling down outside her door on her hands and knees and beating her fists into the dirt and screaming at God. Julie and I drove down from Glacier Point, and even though it was cold, we turned on the heat and rolled down the windows so we could see the stars through the trees. We kept hitting repeat on the CD player and ended up listening to Patty Griffin sing about Mary more than 40 consecutive times. I kept imagining Jesus in my mind like a real person, sometimes out in the wilderness like Yosemite Valley, sometimes by a fire talking with his friends, sometimes thinking about his mother, always missing his father. Rick leads a small group for people who do not believe in Jesus but have questions about him. One of the people in the small group asked Rick what he thought Jesus looked like. Did he look like the pictures on the walls of churches? Rick said he didn't know. One of the other people in the group spoke up very cautiously and said she thought perhaps he looked like Osama bin Laden.
Rick said, this is probably very close to the truth. Sometimes I picture this Osama bin Laden-looking Jesus talking with his friends around a fire, except he is not rambling about anything. He is really listening, not so much pushing an agenda, but being kind and understanding and speaking some truth and encouragement into their lives, helping them believe in the mission they feel inside themselves, the mission that surrounded Jesus and the crazy life they had embraced. I remember the first time I had feelings for Jesus. It wasn't very long ago. I had gone to a conference on the coast with some Reed students, and a man spoke who was a professor at a local Bible college. He spoke mostly about the Bible, about how we should read the Bible. He was convincing. He seemed to have an emotional relationship with the book, the way I think about Catcher in the Rye. This man who was speaking reads through the Bible 3 times each year. I had never read through the Bible at all. I had read a lot of it, but not all of it, and mostly I read it because I felt that I had to. It was healthy or something. The speaker guy asked us to go outside and find a quiet place and get reacquainted with the book, hold it in our hands, and let our eyes feel down the pages. I went out on the steps outside the restroom and opened my Bible to the book of James. Years ago, I had a crush on a girl, and I prayed about it, and that night read through James. And because it is a book about faith and belief, I felt like God was saying that if I had faith, she would marry me. So I was very excited about this and lost a lot of weight, but the girl gave her virginity to a jerk from our youth group, and they are married now. I didn't care, honestly. I didn't love her that much. I only say that because the book of James in my Bible is highlighted in 10 colors and underlined all over the place, and it looks blood raw, and the yellow pages remind me of a day when I believed so faithfully in God, so beautifully in God. I read a little, maybe a few pages, then shut the book, very tired and confused. But when we got back from the conference, I felt like my Bible was calling me. I felt this promise that if I read it, if I just read it like a book, cover to cover, it wouldn't change me into an idiot. It wouldn't change me into a clone of Pat Buchanan. And that was honestly the thing I was worried about with the Bible. If I read it, it would make me simple in my thinking. So I started in Matthew, which is one of the Gospels about Jesus. And I read through Matthew and Mark, then Luke and John. I read those books in a week or so, and Jesus was very confusing, and I didn't know if I liked him very much, and I was certainly tired of him by the second day. By the time I got to the end of Luke, to the part where they were going to kill him again, where they were going to stretch him out on a cross, something shifted within me. I remember it was cold outside, crisp, and the leaves in the trees of the park across the street were getting tired and dry. And I remember sitting at my desk, and I don't know what it was that I read or what Jesus was doing in the book, but I felt a love for him rush through me, through my back and into my chest. I started crying too, like that guy Bill Bright. I remember thinking that I would follow Jesus anywhere, that it didn't matter what he asked me to do. He could be mean to me. It didn't matter. I loved him, and I was going to follow him. I think the most important thing that happens within Christian spirituality is when a person falls in love with Jesus. Sometimes when I go forward at church to take communion, to take the bread and dip it in the wine, the thought of Jesus comes to me, the red of his blood or the smell of his humanity, and I eat the bread and I wonder at the mystery of what I am doing, that somehow I am one with Christ, that I get my very life from him. My spiritual life comes from his working inside me, being inside me. I know our culture will sometimes understand a love for Jesus as weakness. There's this lie floating around that says I'm supposed to be able to do life alone, without any help, without stopping to worship something bigger than myself.
but I actually believe there is something bigger than me, and I need for there to be something bigger than me. I need someone to put awe inside me. I need to come second to someone who has everything figured out. All great characters in stories are the ones who give their lives to something bigger than themselves. And in all of the stories, I don't find anyone more noble than Jesus. He gave his life for me in obedience to his Father. I truly love him for it. I feel that, and so does Laura and Penny and Rick and Tony the Beat Poet. I think the difference in my life came when I realized, after reading those Gospels, that Jesus didn't just love me out of principle. He didn't just love me because it was the right thing to do. Rather, there was something inside me that caused him to love me. I think I realized that if I walked up to his campfire, he would ask me to sit down, and he would ask me my story. He would take the time to listen to my ramblings or my anger until I could calm down, and then he would look me directly in the eye, and he would speak to me. He would tell me the truth, and I would sense in his voice and in the lines on his face that he liked me. He would rebuke me, too, and he would tell me that I have prejudices against very religious people and that I need to deal with that. He would tell me that there are poor people in the world and I need to feed them, and that somehow this will make me more happy. I think he would tell me what my gifts are and why I have them, and he would give me ideas on how to use them. I think he would explain to me why my father left, and he would point out very clearly all the ways God has taken care of me through the years, all the stuff God protected me from. After I got Laura's email in which she told me she had become a Christian, I just about lost it with excitement. I felt like a South African the day they let Mandela out of prison. I called her and asked her to have coffee at Palio. I picked her up in Elliott's Circle at Reed, and she was smiling and full of energy. She said we had much to talk about, very much to talk about. At Palio, we sat in the booth at the back, and even though Laura had been my close friend, I felt like I had never met this woman. She squirmed in her seat as she talked with confidence about her love for Jesus. I sat there amazed, because it is true. People do come to know Jesus. This crazy thing really happens. It isn't just me. I was watching BET one night, and they were interviewing a man about jazz music. He said jazz music was invented by the first generation out of slavery. I thought that was beautiful, because while it is music, it is very hard to put on paper. It is so much more a language of the soul. It is as if the soul is saying something, something about freedom. I think Christian spirituality is like jazz music. I think loving Jesus is something you feel. I think it is something very difficult to get on paper. But it is no less real, no less meaningful, no less beautiful. The first generation out of slavery invented jazz music. It is a music birthed out of freedom. And that is the closest thing I know to Christian spirituality. A music birthed out of freedom. Everybody sings their song the way they feel it. Everybody closes their eyes and lifts up their hands. I want Jesus to happen to you the way he happened to Laura at Reed, the way he happened to Penny in France, the way he happened to me in Texas. I want you to know Jesus too. This book is about the songs my friends and I are singing. This is what God is doing in our lives. But what song will you sing when your soul gets set free? I think it will be something true and beautiful. If you haven't done it in a while, pray and talk to Jesus. Ask him to become real to you. Ask him to forgive you of self-addiction Ask him to put a song in your heart. I can't think of anything better that could happen to you than this. Much love to you, and thanks for listening to us sing. Thank you for listening to this recording of Blue Like Jazz, Non-Religious Thoughts on Christian Spirituality by Donald Miller. This book was read by Scott Brick.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.